Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 88 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lo.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update for Wednesday, August 26th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael, and here are some of the stories we'll be bringing you this hour. Texas families fleeing coast urged to take virus safeguards. As restaurants take over sidewalks to provide pandemic-safe dining, people with disabilities encounter barriers. Why the U.S. is losing the war on COVID-19. A New York City doctor warns of COVID-19's long-term effects. And contagion of fear, 1 month inside a New York hospital as a virus took over the world. First, we'll look at the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County total numbers, both confirmed and probable cases, 4,120. Ector County negative, 18,471 out of 22,876 tested, with 285 pending, 66 deaths. Recovered, 3,318. Active, 736. Midland County, 3,094 confirmed, 64 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, Texas reports less than 5,000 people hospitalized with COVID-19 for the first time since June. 4,907 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of August 25th, 1,303 less than the week before. They occupy 9% of hospital beds. 6,091 new cases were reported on August 25th. The latest positivity rate is 15.4%. 11,576 Texans have died as of August 25th. 181 more deaths reported than the day before, and 1,326 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate is trading today at $43.29, down 6 cents. Now, here are coronavirus briefs. It's Wednesday in the U.S. with more than 5.7 million cases of coronavirus have been reported since the pandemic began, according to the latest tally from Johns Hopkins University. If you're just reading this today, here's a look at the latest updates from across the country. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention revised its guidance for coronavirus testing this week. It now says that many people who have been exposed to the virus through close contact with someone who later tested positive do not necessarily need a test if they are not experiencing symptoms. Experts are expressing concern about the change, noting that people without symptoms are responsible for a large share of transmissions. The CDC also warned shop owners they could be threatened and assaulted by customers upset over mask policies and advised employees not to argue back. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio is urging teachers to hold classes outdoors as plans to resume in-person learning next month continue to face a major backlash and threats of a teacher's strike. Cruise lines are already canceling trips scheduled for early 2021. Appeals by students appear to have largely derailed an anti-mask initiative in Utah that was planned for this week, the Deseret News reported. The annual World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, has been postponed from January until early next summer sometime because of the coronavirus concerns. Detailing numbers and new hotspots. Coronavirus cases in the U.S. are on the decline, but experts say the new reality may be rolling hotspots, where parts of the country are affected by outbreaks while others trend down. Back to college in the U.S. Schools are turning into hotspots as students return back to classes. The University of Alabama reported more than 500 COVID-19 cases less than a week after classes started. At Ohio State, more than 220 students were suspended for violating pandemic precautions before the school year even began. Expert on new CDC guidelines. I'm worried that this is just a way to slow down testing. Dr. Carlos Del Rio, an infectious disease specialist and the associate dean of Emory University School of Medicine, said on CNN Newsroom this morning that he doesn't understand why the CDC changed its guidelines on testing. The CDC changed its COVID-19 testing guidelines to say some people without symptoms may not need to be tested, even if they've been in close contact with someone known to have the virus. Previously, the CDC said viral testing was appropriate for people with recent or suspected exposure, even if they were asymptomatic. Del Rio said the CDC has not provided evidence to explain the changes. I mean, the evidence that I'm aware of, as of today, is that close to 40% of the cases of the infections are asymptomatic, and asymptomatic people transmit the infection, Del Rio said. So not testing, I mean, if you have been in contact with somebody for a few minutes, that's okay. But if you have been in contact for 50 minutes and that people don't have a mask, I think you need to be tested regardless if you have symptoms or not. We know especially young people going into the house and then transmit inside the household. So the guidelines baffle me and I really don't understand them, he said. Del Rio added that he's concerned about politics influencing these decisions. He noted that President Trump has said in the past that more testing leads to more detection of more cases. If we slow down testing, we will have a decrease in cases, Del Rio said. So I am worried that this is just a way to slow down testing, and that would clearly not be good. We don't want to decrease the amount of testing. We want to decrease cases by decreasing transmission, not by decreasing testing. Moderna says vaccine data shows it is well tolerated across all age groups. Moderna's experimental coronavirus vaccine appears to be safe and elicits an immune response in all age groups, including the elderly, a company official said on Wednesday. Data from the Phase 1 safety trial of the vaccine showed only mild adverse effects and generated an immune response in volunteers aged 18 to 71. Dr. Jacqueline Miller, therapeutic area head for infectious diseases at Moderna, told a meeting of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. The Phase 1 trial was conducted in three age groups, 18 to 55, 56 to 70, and 71 plus years of age. Participants received two 100 milligram doses of the vaccine 28 days apart. Neutralizing antibodies, which inactivate the virus, were detected in all participants, including the upper age range, she told the meeting. All age groups also seem to produce the same immune response, a good sign as older people often have weaker responses to vaccines. The most common adverse reactions were fatigue, chills, headache, and myalgia. More reports of adverse symptoms observed after the second dose of the vaccine, but the majority of symptoms resolved within 2 days. ACIP advises the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on how vaccines should be used in the population. Bed Bath & Beyond is laying off 2,800 employees. Bed Bath & Beyond is eliminating 2,800 jobs effective immediately as the troubled retailer tries to streamline its operations and shore up its finances amid the pandemic. The significant reduction of corporate employees and retail workers will help Bed Bath & Beyond save $150 million in annual pre-tax cost savings, the company said Tuesday. As of February, the retailer had 55,000 employees, so the cuts amount to 5% of its total workforce. Tuesday's action forms part of a series of changes we are making to reduce the cost of our business, further simplify our operations, and support our teams so we can emerge from the pandemic in an even stronger position, CEO Mark Triton said in a statement. Some background. Last month, Bed Bath & Beyond announced it was permanently closing 200 stores starting later this year. Brick-and-mortar stores continue to struggle as people shift their shopping online, The company, which also operates Bye Bye Baby, Christmas Tree Shops, and Harmon Face Values, has about 1,500 stores. Nearly 1,000 of those are Bed Bath & Beyond locations. Triton was named Bed Bath & Beyond CEO last October, joining the retailer from Target. In addition to the layoffs and store closures, Triton is bolstering the company's digital efforts and launching new in-house brands next year. Now from the Associated Press. Texas families fleeing coast urged to take virus safeguards. Mass evacuations along the Texas coast as Hurricane Laura approached Tuesday unfolded with the pandemic, also a concern of residents and emergency officials, who urged families to hunker down in hotels instead of shelters and loaded disinfectants onto buses that shuttled families inland to safety. More than 385,000 residents were told to flee the Texas cities of Beaumont, Galveston, and Port Arthur. The National Hurricane Center projected that Laura would draw energy from warm Gulf waters and become a Category 3 hurricane before making landfall in Texas or Louisiana on late Wednesday or early Thursday. The evacuations began another test of the state's handling of the coronavirus, which clobbered Texas this summer and has resulted in more than 11,000 deaths. State officials said buses deployed to the coast were stocked with personal protective equipment and disinfectants, and that buses would make more trips and carry fewer passengers in order to keep people farther apart. Virus testing teams will also be deployed to shelters as soon as practical, said Nim Kidd, chief of the Texas Division of Emergency Management. Officials recommended that families ride out the storm socially distanced in hotels if possible, rather than bunking up in shelters with others. The state and local governments are fully aware that they're dealing with the pandemic while they're responding to Hurricane Laura, Republican Governor Greg Abbott said. The storm approached as the number of COVID-19 patients in Texas hospitals dropped below 5,000 for the first time since June, continuing an encouraging trend after a massive surge in admissions in July. Now we're going to read an article from Time Magazine. Why the U.S. is losing the war on COVID-19. It is a frightening time to live in the United States. COVID-19, a novel disease as ruthless as it is seemingly random, is picking us off by the thousands. Even many of those who recover may never truly be the same again. The pandemic has exposed the gulf between what this country promises for its citizens and what it actually delivers. And as the U.S. barrels toward Election Day, the outbreak is sure to complicate the voting process with potentially disastrous results. For a short time in the spring, it appeared the U.S. was getting a grip on the outbreak. Hard-hit states like New York successfully flattened the curve, thanks largely to a statewide shutdown of non-essential businesses and compliance with new rules requiring that people wear masks and practice social distancing. But as other states began to reopen in late spring or early summer, new hotspots developed. First in the Sun Belt, in states like Texas, Arizona, and Florida. And more recently in the Midwest, in states like Indiana, Illinois, and Minnesota. On the West Coast, California reported a new single-day high for confirmed cases on August 10th. On the East Coast, Virginia did the same on August 7th. Across the country, hospitalization rates have gotten frighteningly high, and more deaths seem bound to follow. The U.S. is surely losing the war on COVID-19, but it did not have to be this way. Of the G7 countries, the U.S., the U.K., Canada, France, Japan, Germany, and Italy, only we have an outbreak that continues to spin out of control. Some other nations, like New Zealand, have even come close to eradicating COVID-19 entirely, a somewhat easier feat in a less populated and more isolated country, to be sure. Depressingly, in the months before the pandemic, the U.S. was considered to be among the countries best prepared to handle a major outbreak. At this point, we can start to see more clearly why the nation has foundered so miserably: a failure of political leadership at all levels, a distrust of scientists, the media, and expertise in general. and deeply ingrained cultural attitudes about individuality and the values placed on life have all combined to result in a horrifically inadequate pandemic response compared to what are traditionally considered the U.S.'s peer nations. That the U.S. federal government has failed in its duty to protect Americans' health and well-being in a time of crisis is, by now, abundantly obvious. Despite the best attempts of public health officials and others, many elected officials in the U.S. did not take the threat of COVID-19 seriously from the jump. By the time it became clear that the virus posed a major threat, federal efforts were confused at best. The government's disarray was best demonstrated by an April episode in which Jared Kushner, senior advisor to his father-in-law, President Donald Trump, and at the time tasked with orchestrating the federal response to the virus, confusingly claimed that a federal stockpile of ventilators, crucial equipment for saving seriously ill patients, was not meant for the states. The notion of the federal stockpile was, it's supposed to be our stockpile. It's not supposed to be state stockpiles that they then use, he said, leaving unclear who exactly those ventilators were for, if not for Americans, the vast majority of whom live in one state or another. In some instances, the federal response exceeded inadequacy and became downright harmful. Desperate for supplies as the pandemic worsened in early April, some hospital executives, doctors, and other caregivers turned to shady dealers to arrange for shipments of overpriced gear from China. At the height of the outbreak, the federal government was intercepting some of those shipments for reasons that remain unclear. Dr. Andrew W. Artenstein, chief physician executive at non-for-profit healthcare network Bay State Health in Springfield, Massachusetts, even claimed he had to go so far as to ship personal protective equipment in trucks, cleverly masked as food service vehicles, to evade a possible federal seizure. The story would make for a pretty good Smokey and the Bandit reboot if it weren't so maddening. A complete catalog of Trump's failures to adequately address the pandemic is the stuff of books, not single articles. But a quick summary. He wasted weeks early on downplaying the virus. He has stubbornly clung to a fantastical belief that the virus will simply disappear. He banned many travelers from China, but squandered the time the move bought him by failing to set up an adequate testing and tracing program. He encouraged states to reopen ahead of his own administration's guidelines. And he has repeatedly cherry-picked statistics that make the situation in the U.S. look far better than it is in reality. Most recently in a disastrous interview with Axios on HBO, released August 3rd, in which he mischaracterized the U.S. death rate from the virus. Then there were the masks. Experts say that one of Trump's most significant missteps was his refusal until recently to be seen in public wearing a face covering. It's established science that wearing a facial covering significantly reduces the spread of COVID-19, and a pre-existing culture of mask wearing in East Asia is often cited as a central reason that many places in that region were able to quickly control their outbreaks. But in a country without such an existing norm, it's incumbent upon leaders, political and otherwise, to model that behavior. When Trump appeared in the White House briefing room on April 3rd to announce recommendations from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, that every American should wear a cloth face covering, he undercut the advice of his administration's own experts by emphasizing that mask wearing would still be voluntary, and that he personally wouldn't be doing it. Trump, a man long obsessed with self-image, continued to mostly reject masks until a visit to Walter Reed National Military Medical Center on July 11th, at which point more than 130,000 Americans had already died of COVID-19. Trump has since softened on mask wearing somewhat, following pressure from allies like South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham and Fox & Friends co-host Steve Ducey. I view it this way. Anything that potentially can help, and masks certainly can potentially help, is a good thing, the president said during a July 21st coronavirus briefing. I have no problem. I carry it. I wear it. You saw me wearing it a number of times, and I'll continue. But Trump's early defiance set the tone for his party and his followers, no doubt contributing to the depressingly predictable politicization of mask wearing. A Pew Research Center survey published on June 25th, 2 weeks before the huge resurgence of the virus in early July, found that 63% of Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents said masks should always be worn, compared with only 29% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents. Nearly a quarter of Republicans, 23%, said masks should never or rarely be worn. As the virus rages on and more people view it as an imminent threat, attitudes are changing. 58% of Republicans now say they favor wearing a mask in public, according to a July 23rd poll from the Associated Press and the NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. But that's still far below the 89% of Democrats who say so. Meanwhile, stories of violent encounters between mask skeptics and mask wearers continue to make headlines nearly every week. Masks aside, the most glaring failure of the federal government has been, and continues to be, a lack of adequate testing infrastructure, which is a key element of pandemic response, as testing shows how bad an outbreak is getting and reveals key hotspots. Testing shortages and delays were a major problem early in the U.S. outbreak before capabilities were ramped up, and are once again plaguing the country as the virus spreads across multiple states. Some Americans say they are waiting more than 2 weeks for their test results, which researchers say become effectively useless after only 2 days. The longer people go between getting tested and receiving their results, the bigger the window of opportunity for them to get infected in the interim. The delays, which are being caused by a mixture of labs' inability to get the necessary supplies to run tests, a lack of cooperation between rival labs, and inadequate federal guidance, have gotten so bad that demand for tests across the U.S. has actually decreased, even as the virus continues to spread, a sign that Americans are simply too fed up with waiting for their results to even bother getting tested in the first place. New rules preventing asymptomatic people from getting tested in some states are also depressing demand. Rather than call for more testing capacity, Trump has instead suggested that maybe the U.S. should be testing less. He has repeatedly and incorrectly blamed the recent increase in cases in the U.S. entirely on increased testing. While the U.S. is indeed running more tests than any other country, the percentage of those tests coming back positive increased from about 4.5% in mid-June to nearly 8% by August 12th, according to the COVID Tracking Project, suggesting the virus is spreading whether we test for it or not. By comparison, Germany's daily positivity rate is under 3%. In Italy, it's about 2%. And in New Zealand, it's under 0.5%. Increased testing capacity has been a problem for the president because it has revealed the alarming depth of the U.S. outbreak. For Trump, the U.S. caseload isn't a matter of public health. It's more like a golf score. The higher it goes, the worse he's doing, and he only has so much time left to reverse things before the 18th hole, this November's election. But rather than address the root cause of the expanding outbreak, he's simply blaming his embarrassing results on the scorekeeping. If we didn't do testing, we'd have no cases, the president said during a Fox News event in June. When you do tests, you have cases. In reality, knowing the true scope of the outbreak can help public health officials, lawmakers, and so on make better, smarter choices, so long as they know the actual score. Take a quick scroll through your Facebook feed. If you're like many Americans, there's a good chance you'll see, mixed in with photos of babies and vacations, posts that falsely claim COVID-19 is a Bill Gates-led global conspiracy, or falsely claim that Mixing ginseng, orange juice, and cooking oil is the secret cure. Or falsely claim that the entire pandemic is a hoax. Facebook and other social media companies are at least trying to fight outbreak disinformation, but that's a Sisyphean task if there ever was one. Despite the corrosive effect of social media, Americans overall tend to have more trust in science than those in many other countries, according to a 2018 study from the Wellcome Trust. Our faith in scientific leaders has remained steady over the last several decades, with around 40% of Americans saying they have a great deal of confidence in the scientific community every year since 1973, according to the NORC Center. Furthermore, before the pandemic, the share of Americans who had at least a fair amount of confidence that scientists work in the public interest was as high as 86% in 2019, according to Pew. However, digging deeper reveals a disturbing partisan trend that's now playing out in important ways. While 43% of Democrats still told Pew in 2019 that they had a great deal of trust in scientists, only 27% of Republicans said the same. Moreover, Democrats were also more likely, 73%, than Republicans, 43%, to believe scientists should take an active role in policy debates, results that foreshadow the American right wing's ongoing efforts to minimize public health officials and other experts. In a survey published in June, researchers at Johns Hopkins University, JHU, found that while 89% of Democrats viewed social distancing to be very important, the same was true of just 66% of Republicans. The JHU researchers also found that a person's faith in science tends to predict whether they will follow public health guidelines. While 80% of Republicans who trust science said social distancing was important, only 55% of Republicans who doubt science said the same. The president and other national leaders and commentators on the right have routinely disparaged public health officials throughout the crisis, often criticizing their calls for shutting down businesses and other drastic but necessary measures. Trump has also amplified messages that undermine the legitimacy of America's public health institutions. "The most outrageous lies are the ones about COVID-19, tweeted Chuck Woolery, a former game show host turned political commentator, on July 12th. "Everyone is lying. The CDC, media, Democrats, our doctors, not all but most that we are told to trust." A day later, Trump retweeted Woolery's message to his 83 million followers. Not a single person better represents the bitter politicization of science than Dr. Anthony Fauci, longtime head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Fauci, whose job during the pandemic is primarily to coordinate vaccine development and communicate with a frightened public, has been the foremost U.S. scientist on COVID-19. He's also a straight shooter, whose candid admissions about the country's failings to handle the outbreak has put him at odds with most others in the Trump administration, leading to a very public falling out with the president. While Fauci's responses to Trump's criticisms have been mild and measured, "I have not been misleading the American public under any circumstances," he said on ABC's Good Morning America on July 28th after Trump retweeted messages suggesting otherwise. Trump's attacks have centered Fauci in the public debate. He is now in many ways this crisis's Robert Mueller, an old-school civil servant whom Trump's supporters see as an enemy, but his detractors view as a hero. The reality, however, is that Fauci, like Mueller, is just a guy trying to do his job as best he can, despite the heavily politicized circumstances. Some lost faith in science is at least understandable, given that public health organizations' COVID-19 recommendations are continually changing. That's rooted in the reality that scientific understanding of a newly emergent virus is evolving in real time. Science is slow, the virus is fast, but the ever-changing advice can make it seem like public health officials don't know what they're doing. When groups like the World Health Organization are late to recommend that people wear cloth face coverings and to accept that SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, is likely airborne, it doesn't instill public confidence, especially in those already primed to be skeptical of experts. It's genuinely a confusing information environment that we're in right now, says Dr. Colleen Berry, chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. In an issue that's life or death, people want to know what they should do and what they shouldn't do. Because this is a new infectious disease, a new virus, we don't have all the answers scientifically. Sometimes we have little pieces of information, but they don't fit together in a broader answer to specific questions. I think that creates an environment that could potentially erode trust even further over time. Truly worrying are the numbers of Americans who already say they are hesitant to receive a COVID-19 vaccination if and when one becomes available. Given recent research suggesting that natural herd immunity to this virus is all but impossible to achieve, a vaccine is our only way back to anything resembling normal life. But mass vaccination will only work with enough buy-in from a trusting public. The damage that the president and others are doing to Americans' trust in science and professional expertise could have significant consequences on the country's ability to get past this pandemic, even if Trump doesn't win a second term this November. It's no secret that Americans tend to be more individualistic than people in many other nations. A 2011 Pew survey found that 58% of Americans said that freedom to pursue life's goals without interference from the state is more important than the state guaranteeing nobody is in need, compared to just 38% of Britons, 36% of Germans, and the French, and 30% of Spaniards. It's easy to view that trait as a root cause of this country's struggles with COVID-19. After all, a pandemic requires individuals to make temporary sacrifices for the collective good, whether it's wearing a mask they find uncomfortable or canceling a planned birthday party. But in reality, Americans have shown time and again that they're willing to work together to achieve a common goal, especially in times of crisis. Most of the country's greatest achievements, from independence to defeating the surge of 20th century Nazism to putting humans on the moon, were largely collective efforts. We do come together on many, many things when we have good leadership, says Dr. David Rosner, a professor at Columbia University who specializes in the history of public health. In terms of COVID-19, perhaps more instructive than Americans' general views on individualism are our specific beliefs regarding sickness itself. Americans have had mixed views on disease since the colonial era, Rosner says, with some viewing it as a public issue requiring collective action and others as a matter that should be left to those who get sick. The words and deeds of the country's leaders can push the national sentiment in either of those directions, argues Rosner, and Trump has clearly opted for the latter. We take our cues from leaders, Rosner says, and if they seem to suggest that I, being a moral person, will not get a disease and will not be sick and I can go around and not wear my mask, because after all, it's only the weak and the vulnerable and the stupid and the immigrant, that it's the other that really is vulnerable. Well, then, Americans will start to believe that, too. There's another disturbing undercurrent to Americans' attitude toward the pandemic thus far, a willingness to accept mass death as an unavoidable part of everyday life. We as a nation have become dull to tragedy as a result of near daily exposure to unspeakable horrors, from wanton gun violence to the seemingly never-ending incidents of police brutality, to the ongoing clean water crisis in Flint, Michigan, and elsewhere. In retrospect, Sandy Hook marked the end of the U.S. gun control debate. Columnist Dan Hodges memorably remarked, nearly 3 years after the 2012 tragedy in which a gunman shot and killed 26 people at a Connecticut elementary school, Congress failed to pass any new gun laws in the wake of this horrific incident. Once America decided killing children was bearable, it was over, Hodges wrote. It is difficult to quantify apathy, but what besides a torpid acceptance that thousands more Americans will inevitably die of COVID-19 can explain that a quarter of Americans, roughly 82 million people, still don't believe masks should always be worn in public places? What else can explain that Disney World, partially reopened to guests on July 11th, a day before its home state of Florida reported more than 15,000 new daily cases, setting what was then a record for all U.S. states, and people showed up en masse? What else can explain that while air travel is down significantly, hundreds of thousands of people, mostly vacationers, are still boarding airplanes every day, potentially spreading the virus as they move about the country, whether they know it or not? There are reasons to be optimistic about the future of the pandemic in the U.S. So far, America's new hotspots have not seen the catastrophic mortality rate that befell states like New York and New Jersey. Most likely, that's because deaths are a lagging indicator. But it could also be because physicians have gotten better at treating the virus. That California's governor announced a major rollback of his reopening plan in mid-July amid a worrying new spike in cases shows that at least some leaders are rethinking their strategies to match reality. Multiple efforts to create a vaccine continue apace. It's possible that at least one will be available by the end of the year, though that's probably a generous estimate. And there's a chance that as the virus rages on, more Americans will get on board with public health measures. There's a learning curve for the public around what's really happening, and in my estimation, at least over the long term, offers a potential for convergence, says Dr. Ann Keller, an associate professor at UC Berkeley School of Public Health, who specializes in health politics and policy. That Americans will start to say, if everyone's not wearing masks, if everyone's not social distancing, if people are having family parties inside with lots of people together, if we're flouting the public health recommendations, we're going to keep seeing transmission. Regardless, the pandemic seems likely to leave the U.S. weakened and adrift for at least the near term, with hundreds of thousands, possibly even millions of its citizens dead. It has already exposed significant foundational flaws, from a disastrously frayed social safety net to life-threatening systemic racism. It has made clear that many of us do not think of ourselves as our brother's keepers, perhaps forever damaging any sense of community among neighbors. And it has crippled our standing on the world stage. Who would want to import American ideals when those ideals bring death on a mass scale? Many Americans will not survive this pandemic. Those who do will be left with considerable work to fix ourselves and our country. With reporting from Emily Barone and fact-checking from Julia Zorthian and Mariah Espada. Now I'm going to read an article also from Time Magazine. This, at the end of this article, which is fairly short, we'll also include a 5-minute interview with Katie Couric and a doctor. The title of the article is A New York City Doctor Warns of COVID-19's Long-Term Effects. Most people who are infected with COVID-19 ultimately survive, but for many patients, that may mean living with life-altering symptoms that linger or become permanent. In a conversation with Katie Couric for Time, Dr. Roni Shimoni, a cardiologist at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, said he and his colleagues have noticed that patients as young as their 30s who survived COVID-19 are reporting lasting symptoms. Doctors have discovered issues including kidney damage, reduction in heart function, and cognitive impairment in patients who had been infected with COVID-19, Shimoni said, adding that the sicker the patients had been from COVID-19, the greater the damage to their organs. We're now beginning to understand the impact on the brain, on the heart, on the lungs, on the kidneys, Shimoni said. This particular infection is involving all their body. we need to really take time to understand further the impact on it, and it really causes us to be more cautious about what's coming ahead. History raises further cause for concern. After the Spanish flu of 1918, Shimoni said as many as 50 to 60% of patients were found to still have effects 4 years later. He expects we will see a similar effect with COVID-19. Fortunately, scientists and doctors are learning about how to treat patients with the disease, including the importance of starting treatment early to head off the risk of organ damage, Shimoni said. However, the risk of long-term effects means it's vital to prevent the disease from spreading. This is a disease that can leave people disabled for years to come, or a lifetime, Shimoni said. The impact it has on a family, psychologically, financially, etc., that's an impact for the country. So we have to build up prevention. We have to listen to the experts, wear the mask, and the social distancing. Below the article, it notes that this interview is part of a special series produced in collaboration with Katie Couric. Read more from Time Reports with Katie Couric and sign up for her weekday morning newsletter, Wake Up Call with Katie Couric. Now, here's the related 5-minute interview that Katie Couric did with Dr. Shimoni.
My colleagues and I are seeing groups that are in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, as well as 60s, that have survived COVID. 19 come in and they still have significant symptoms. We're now beginning to understand the impact on the brain, on the heart, on the lungs, on the kidneys. This particular infection is involving all the body. We need to really take time to understand further the impact on it, and it really causes us to be more cautious about what's coming ahead.
Let me ask you this, Dr. Shimoni. Are you more likely to have long-term effects if you were very sick? What about if you were not that sick or even asymptomatic?
The sicker the patients were, the more organ damage they had. Even though some suffer more with breathlessness and lung injury, some of the more subtle things that were not appreciated early on is cognitive issues. We talk about a brain fog, anxiety, depression. Remember, the lungs were damaged. A lot of patients could not be oxygenated very well. So the brain did not see enough oxygen. That led to cognitive impairment in 1/3 of the patients. We're also seeing reduction in heart function. Kidney damage was seen very often and very quickly in the acutely ill patients. The virus has triggered this cascade of events. The cascade of events not only involves the virus in the immune system, the body has a tendency to form clots. That leads to tissue destruction because the tissue is not getting the blood supply it's supposed to. And since all the organs are tied together and all the blood circulates in 1 minute across all of them, you can see how this is all tied in together. And of course, some people were not as sick, and obviously the underlying conditions dictated a lot of that. If your baseline is very, very good to start with, for those who are younger, you may see less effects, but you may not be able to do what you could do before.
When will you know if the impact of a lot of these things is permanent?
I think as time goes on, we'll get a better idea where the baseline of patients are. In the Spanish flu in 1918, as many as 50 to 60% of patients in a 4-year follow-up had symptoms 4 years after the pandemic. We will see something similar with long-term effects. I think over the next multiple months, we have to really address the survivors and to say to them, we understand you're not feeling well. We know why you're not feeling well. This is not psychological. We can help you assess what's going on and what can be done.
Now we just have time for 2 short recorded reports. This first one is when the FDA might approve a coronavirus vaccine.
The Trump administration launched Operation Warp Speed in May. The goal is to deliver initial doses of a safe and effective COVID-19 vaccine by this coming January. That would be a speed record for developing a vaccine, and some fear the administration might cut corners to meet that ambitious schedule as a way to gain a political advantage. Joining us to talk about this confluence of science and politics is NPR's Joe Palca. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Ari.
The administration says it wants to cut through red tape to speed up the approval process. So how much red tape is there?
Well, the job of approving a vaccine falls to the Food and Drug Administration, and yes, there is some red tape, but the whole reason the FDA exists is to protect the American people from unsafe and ineffective products. So at a minimum, FDA wants to see any vaccine tested in thousands of people and that any relative side effects will be found, and if the vaccine is, and they want to know if the vaccine is actually preventing disease. And the FDA says the vaccine doesn't have to prevent 100% of disease to get a green light, just 50% would be sufficient.
How soon can those tests be completed?
Well, large studies are underway now involving tens of thousands of people, but you can only speed up these trials so much. For example, some of the vaccines require two doses a month apart, and you can't shorten a month into 2 weeks. It doesn't work. So now there's a separate outside group called the Data Safety and Monitoring Board, keeping an eye on things, and they see the data from the study as it comes in. Paul Offit is a vaccine developer at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's expressed concerns that the Trump administration could try to say a vaccine is successful before the data show that. But he trusts this outside board will make sure there are no dangerous side effects from the vaccine.
If they see strong, clear, statistically robust evidence that a vaccine is effective and they feel that trial could even be stopped early for that reason, great, I'm all for it.
So let's imagine they do see this evidence. What happens then?
Well, normally that would allow the manufacturer to come to the FDA and say, look, we have a working vaccine. And at that point, the FDA could agree and issue something called an emergency use authorization, or EUA. But things get a little murky here because the FDA doesn't have to show the data it's using to make its decision. But in this case, the FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn has promised that the agency would share the data. This is what he wrote in an editorial in the medical journal JAMA. Transparent discussion at FDA's Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee will be needed prior to vaccine authorization or licensure to ensure clear public understanding of the evidence supporting vaccine safety and efficacy.
Okay, so if there is that transparency and everybody gets to see the evidence, does that mean everyone will be convinced?
No. No, because there's always differences of opinion. It's rarely clear that something is absolutely working or absolutely not working. But Offit says the worst thing would be to authorize the use of an ineffective vaccine to try to stop the pandemic.
Don't screw this up. The vaccine is our best way out of it at this point. And to shake the American confidence further with either an unsafe or ineffective vaccine would be, I think, a disaster.
The last word there from Dr. Paul Offit, brought to us by NPR's Joe Palca. Thanks, Joe.
You're welcome, Ari.
The Food and Drug Administration's mission is to protect public health by assuring the American people of the safety and efficacy of drugs. Now many scientists are saying that mission has been compromised after a Sunday news conference in which the head of the FDA, Stephen Hahn, stood beside the president and made this false statement about the efficacy of plasma for treating COVID-19.
35% improvement in survival is a pretty substantial clinical benefit. What that means is, and if the data continue to pan out, 100 people who are sick with COVID-19, 35 would have been saved because of the administration of plasma.
After many scientists criticized that statement, Hahn corrected himself on Twitter late yesterday and said that criticism was justified. One of those critics is Dr. Eric Topol of the Scripps Translational Research Institute in La Jolla, California, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Ari.
You tweeted at Hahn saying, serious mistakes undermine your credibility. How serious is this mistake?
Extremely serious. This is about a treatment that has no proven benefit, and we have the FDA as well as the Secretary of HHS, the President, all claiming that it's a breakthrough. And I could not be further from the truth. There is no evidence for that.
It's still inaccurate to say 35 of those 100 who would die would be saved by plasma, right?
Right. So that's the next level of the problem. This was based on a Mayo Clinic preprint that has not been peer-reviewed and will not currently, as it stands, hold up to peer review. It's a tortured analysis from 35,000 people who got the convalescent plasma, which drilled down to 1,000 people at Mayo Clinic who got the plasma early, of a certain age. All these cherry-picking subgroups of subgroups. And that's where they came up with this 35%. A careful review of the preprint from which it is based suggests that that number would equate to 3 or 4 lives saved out of 100 people who would otherwise die. So basically what it is a 10 times, that's how much exaggeration it is, an order of magnitude 10 times more than the data from an exploratory analysis indicates. This is so extraordinary to take the number of 3 or 4 and to make it into 35.
So you're saying this is an overstatement, the numbers are wrong. He made a mistake and he admitted that mistake. Does that mean that this plasma treatment should not have been approved, is not safe?
Well, I don't think the problem here is the approval on an emergency authorization basis. The problem is the hyperbole and the false statements that are not supported by facts or evidence. So in order to get this straight, Dr. Hahn needs to also talk to the public and say that he erred and that there is no established evidence for survival advantage of convalescent plasma. That has to be determined through randomized trials that are ongoing. And as you know, Ari, you know, millions of people tuned into this breakthrough press conference and have read the outgrowth of it. So this has to get corrected.
You know, Dr. Topol, this administration often makes misleading statements. Why does this one stand out to you?
Well, in two important ways. First of all, it's completely false. There is no evidence to support these statements of a major advance or fulfilling any dream. But the other thing that's especially troubling is the fact that a vaccine could also be given emergency authorization without sufficient data for it working or being safe. And so when politics mixes with science, as is evidenced here, that could be precursor to an even worse situation with the vaccine in imminent weeks.
Eric Topol is Executive Vice President of the Scripps Translational Research Institute in La Jolla, California. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you, Ari.
And we reached out to the FDA for comment. They did not reply by airtime.
And finally, here's another report from NPR about how nursing home employees' musical talent uplifts residents.
Many nursing homes are not letting visitors in during the pandemic, which means they have to get creative to boost morale. In Marion, Alabama, one nursing home employee turned to the power of music. From WBHM, Mary Scott Hodgen reports.
For as long as she can remember, Ashley Moore has loved to sing.
If he had not been.
Singing is just, it's in my blood. I've been doing it all my life.
Moore is a licensed practical nurse at Perry County Nursing Home. When she started working there about 3 years ago, Moore would occasionally hum a tune while walking the halls. A few residents started to notice, and they loved it.
From then on, I sang because I didn't. You know, they're living in the nursing home. This is where they're going to be. I don't exactly know how they're feeling at the moment, but if I can do anything to brighten their day, I will.
She started singing during activities and church services. She'd even meet one-on-one with residents to sing their favorite songs.
Thank you, Lord. I won't complain.
But earlier this year, that kind of thing became more difficult. Since March, the coronavirus has spread through thousands of nursing homes across the U.S., including the Perry County Nursing Home. People haven't been able to visit in person, and there haven't been as many group activities or group singing. Fannie Bates is 75 years old and says it's been a difficult time.
These past few months have been, I don't know, it's very lonesome because most people are used to their family. You know, getting together and everything.
Ashley Moore says it's also been stressful for staff. The restrictions, the health risks. She says they can't interact with residents like they used to. But at the same time, residents need them even more.
We were just trying to figure out ways to continue to try to keep some kind of normalcy in there.
Sharon Phillips is the administrator at Perry County Nursing Home. She says one idea was to use the intercom to deliver inspiring messages, but they needed a volunteer.
And Ashley said, I will. And she got on the pager and said a prayer, and then started singing on her own.
In the middle of the hallway in her purple scrubs, Ashley Moore belted gospel hymns throughout the facility. Moore says she sung a lot over the years, but this time it was different.
The reaction was nothing like I thought it would be. Everybody hears me sing. I didn't know that those words, that song meant so much to them. People were even crying.
She says one of those people was Fanny Bates. She's one of Moore's biggest fans. Bates says for her, every song is spiritual, and she says you can hear that in Moore's voice.
She does a great job with singing and a great meaning to it. And I just love something like that.
Take my hand, precious Lord, and lead me on.
Bates says she also loves to sing. She says it makes her feel better, even when she's lonely. For NPR News, I'm Mary Scott Hodgen.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Wednesday, August 26th, from the Recording Library of West Texas. Coming up, we'll have USA Today with national news, followed by our local news at 3 o'clock. And here are some of the articles our volunteers will be reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Board proposes to terminate Riddick's contract. Hospital CEO says COVID-19 situation is improving. ECISD says Midland man being held on charge of improper relationship. Environmental unit to stay with DA's office. And then the Odessa American is continuing their series, Odessa Strong, 1 year later, with this story, Angels Watching Over Him. Native California says he is one of the lucky ones. We'll also bring you local articles, including Court sets tax rate, views solar project taxes, and prayer service to mark shooting. Those are some of the articles we'll read locally from the local newspapers today at 3 o'clock. At 6 o'clock, of course, we'll have the Wall Street Journal. And then at 7 o'clock tonight, as we do every Wednesday at 7, we'll bring you our Center Solutions podcast. Tonight's episode is an encore edition of the first podcast that Christy Edwards, Melanie Seiss from Centers for Children and Families, and our executive director, Bailey Hennis from the Recording Library, recorded right after the pandemic began. It's titled The Sky is Falling, and it's a general overview of the pandemic and how it is affecting our lives and some tips to help cope through the pandemic. Once again, the Centers Solutions podcast tonight at 7 o'clock. Thank you for being with us. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3. Recording Library of West Texas produces weekly podcasts in association with Centers.